The Fern Lawn is supported by the Alaska Rock Gym. Providing quality indoor climbing to the Anchorage community since 1995, Alaska Rock Gym sports 20,000 square feet of climbing, an entire floor of boulder terrain, beautiful locker rooms, plus expanded cardio fitness and yoga rooms. Whether you're looking to on-site that burly 512 at your local crag or training for a speedy ascent of the Cassine Ridge on Denali, the Alaska Rock Gym has something for everyone. Stop by anytime to take a tour of the facility or check them out at alaskarockgym.com.
Hey, Evan, did you hear that?
Dude, it's a hoarding marmot. Looking for that last-minute piece of kit before heading into the hills? Stop by the Hoarding Marmot, Anchorage's finest outdoor consignment shop, located in the heart of Spinard. The Hoarding Marmot has everything you need, from high-end mountaineering equipment, cross-country and downhill ski gear, plus a fine selection of local guidebooks, maps, and yummy trail snacks. Stop by the Hoarding Marmot next time you're in town, or check them out online at hoardingmarmot.com. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. In season four, we're talking about resilience, the monumental challenges people face in and out of the mountains, and the solutions they find to move forward in the face of adversity. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with extraordinary people, the folks that choose to live full-value lifestyles in some of the most beautiful and wild regions on the planet. All right, well, it's great to be back with you for another episode of The Fern Line. I hope you're all staying healthy, getting outside as much as possible with your friends, family, and the people who are important to you in your life. Some quick business before we get into the show. As always, if you enjoy this podcast, if The Fern Line adds value to your life, there's a few ways you can help out. You can become a monthly subscriber over on Patreon, where you can get early access to episodes, stickers and music, plus other bonus content. To become a subscriber, just head on over to thefernline.com and click Support the Fern Line. Other ways you can support the show are by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And finally, you can simply tell someone. Tell your friends, your climbing partners, people you think might dig the Fern Line. Let them know it's out there. All right, so with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch, camp chair, or your favorite alpine valley, and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line. Hey, just a quick note. This episode contains themes around mental illness and suicide. I know these topics can be upsetting, they can bring up feelings for people, and so I just want to be transparent about that before you start listening. All right. I first met Tom Sardi in the summer of 1998. My recollection is that I was camped under the granite towers of Archangel Valley in Hatcher Pass when my friend Zach arrived with Tom in tow for a day of rock climbing. Zach and I had met just a few months prior, when we'd spent 3 weeks guiding clients up the west buttress of Denali. We'd become instant friends on that trip, and I was glad to be climbing out in the real world with Zach and his friend Tom. It must have been July, as the days were long and the sun was powerful. I have memories of hiking up a mossy, Tolkien-esque valley to a prominent rock band that was split by two striking cracks where we climbed all afternoon. What I remember about that day is that we laughed a lot. And even though Tom seemed a bit shy and introverted, it was clear he was comfortable with Zach and me as well. Like a lot of days back then, it was a memorable moment in the mountains, being young and healthy and just simply climbing for the pure joy of it with friends. I never climbed with Tom again, but I did stay in touch with Zach. And it was a few years later that I remember Zach mentioning that Tom was struggling with mental illness. By that time, my own life had changed dramatically. In 2002, I sustained an injury that effectively ended my climbing career, and so I started to drift away from that part of my life. But I still stayed in touch with Zach, and as the years went by, we'd run into each other from time to time, and we'd always be glad to catch up. Zach would also fill me in about Tom, who by that time was living on the streets, lost in the paranoid confusion of schizophrenia. As sad as it was, I didn't think much of it until around maybe 2010. One day, I stopped to grab a coffee near the REI in Anchorage when I noticed a figure moving toward me. But something about the person looked familiar. He was disheveled, his clothes soiled and torn, with dirty, matted hair poking out of a beanie
with a scraggly red beard.
Without another thought, I approached him and said, "Hey, Tom, it's me, Evan." Tom hesitated, but then he seemed to understand who I was. As we spoke, he had an almost euphoric expression
that seemed to look beyond me,
into a world that only he could understand. I asked him if he was okay, where he was staying, if he was hungry. He acknowledged that he was living in the woods, but he seemed nonchalant about it, almost like it was no big deal. I offered him the $20 bill in my pocket, which he eagerly accepted. When we said goodbye a few minutes later, I looked back as he quickly beelined for the Subway sandwich shop across the street. The encounter left me shaken. Tom was a shell of the vibrant 18-year-old I'd climbed with years before. I could only imagine what it was like to live inside his mind. Over the next few years, I saw Tom frequently, usually around the parking lot of REI, sometimes on the coastal trail, and other times, random places around Anchorage. Tom and I spoke a few more times, but as the months went on, he started avoiding me when we made eye contact. And then, as the months turned into years, I stopped seeing Tom altogether. But then, in May 2019, out of the blue, I heard a story on the radio. It was an interview with Maren Sardi, Tom's sister, who had recently published a memoir titled The Edge of Every Day,
which detailed her family's struggle, and Tom's struggle in particular,
with schizophrenia. I listened intently, taking in the information almost methodically, so I could try and piece together what had happened to him. And then at the end of the segment, I understood at last when the reporter stated plainly that Tom had died in 2014. A few months ago, I was fortunate to speak with Maren about her brother Tom and what it meant for her to write The Edge of Every Day. Although I learned a lot more about Tom in our conversation, I also learned that Maren's family, like my own family, like a lot of families, have a long and complicated history with mental illness.
I mean, my memories of my early childhood are sort of the classic sun-soaked, glorious, sparkling Alaskan childhood memories kind of thing. Mm-hmm. My parents, you know, they were very active. We would go camping. My mom was always gardening. My dad was always fixing up the house. I have memories of this sort of lively household where something interesting was always going on. My dad had a boat that he used to take us across the bay from Homer to Seldovia. He had bought a little piece of property on the beach there, and we didn't have any sort of structure built on it, but we would, you know, ride across the water and then camp there near the beach and go fishing and crabbing, for a week at a time. And I have very vivid memories of that. Often, you know, the sort of classic sitting in the rain for 5 days in a row Alaskan experience, but also some gloriously fun, sunny 4th of July type days. And we would go with another family that we were friends with. So that's a pretty, I think, emblematic memory of what my life was like.
Right. And you talk about these memories in the book, but can you describe Tom as a child and maybe some memories that you have of him as a child?
Sure. So Tom was the baby of the family. There were four of us, and my mom had four kids in a little over 5 years. So we were all very close together in age, and Tom was the youngest. And my memories of him as a small child, he was a very sort of gleeful kid. He loved to find, you know, weird things to do to occupy himself. He was always coming up with schemes, but he wasn't like a wild kid. He just liked coming up with interesting things to do for fun. You know, we would invent games together. And he was also pretty fearless. I have one great memory that I talk about with my sister that happened when we were a little older. My mom had gotten us these little rafts to paddle around on this pond near our house, kind of a big pond, but it was shallow. These inflatable rafts, and they had the oarlocks with oars. And we were paddling around on that pond. I was probably 11 or so, and 11 or 12, I guess Tom would have been 8 or 9. And we lost one of the oars, and this big, mean dog that was chained to a doghouse in a neighbor's yard came and took the oar. So we had to go through this whole process of figuring out how to get it back. And we got it out of the water, and we were standing there, and my sister and I were trying to confer, like, how on earth can we get this away from the dog? The owner wasn't home. And Tom, while we were talking, he just walked away, picked up a big stick, walked right up to the dog, poked it once, grabbed the oar, and came back with the oar in his hand. And he was like, here you go. I think that's a really classic Tom story. Both he was just fearless, and we were always finding interesting things to do, and kind of like nothing was beyond him. And he was important to me in that way too in our childhood, because growing up with our mother being sick, he and my younger sister and me really leaned on each other a lot. And Tom was a really steady influence for me. He was a gentle, calm person. So when he got sick, I lost that from him as well, which was part of what made it so hard for me.
Right. Like, you know, still kind of being back in that time frame in your life, can you talk about when things started to change? And I know, you know, I'm trying to remember from reading the book, but I seem to remember there being, the way you were describing it, was like things were happening and they were affecting you, but it wasn't until like a while later that you started to realize maybe how sick your mom was.
Yeah, it really sort of slowly faded in, both in terms of her mental state worsening and in terms of, you know, us children recognizing that something was off, and even my dad recognizing that something was off. It started when I was about 9, I think, is probably the earliest I can remember having a moment where I was like, this isn't adding up. Because my mom had really been kind of a super mom before that, you know, always doing crafts projects with us and, you know, in the PTA and leading the Girl Scouts and things like that. She just ran the house. It was a really tight ship, you know, and there were moments when suddenly things started to like not happen like they were supposed to or go wrong in ways that were minor. But for me as a child, I think they raised the question of like, what's happening here that's causing this to go wrong? Things like, you know, I would be ready to go to school and she wouldn't have any food to make lunch for us. And then I remember once her talking me into going to school and promising that she would come later after she had run to the store to buy bread and she would bring my lunch, and she never showed up. And then I was standing outside the cafeteria and I didn't go in because I didn't have my lunch, and I was kind of freaked out. And then a teacher came up to me and asked me if I was okay, and I just burst into tears. And 10 minutes later, my mom showed up with my lunch. So it was that kind of thing. And then like sometime later, I was in the cafeteria. I opened my lunch box, and all that was in it was some wedges of lemon, a bag of white sugar, and a bag of dry Cheerios. And that was my lunch. So those moments, because they were incoherent, you know, really kind of seared into me that something was happening and I had no idea what it was. At the same time, you know, the house was becoming more of a mess and my parents were fighting more and more. My dad didn't yet recognize what was happening. You know, it was the 80s. This wasn't a thing that was really in the air for, you know, there was no reason why he would have recognized what was happening. And he was a businessman, you know, he wasn't someone who you could expect to have some kind of expertise in this. So there was the fighting that happened. And then eventually my dad moved out. And it was kind of after he moved out that my mom's condition really deteriorated. And she started to become quite paranoid and started kind of keeping us in the house, refusing to let us go outside. She would bar the door with furniture at night and refused to let us open the window in our bedroom when we slept and things like that. And I later learned that she did believe that assassins were trying to kill us. It was a pretty complex delusion that was forming in her mind that was terrifying her. And around this time, eventually, my grandparents and my dad and my Aunt Julie all stepped in and were trying to get her to seek help and to accept help. And that was the point at which she was hospitalized once, the first time she was hospitalized. My dad sat us down and explained that our mother had a mental illness and that it wasn't her fault and that everybody was doing what they could to try to help her. So that was when I first heard the words. And I really appreciate that my dad sat us down and made that clear to us and framed it in a way that was both accurate and optimistic, because that helped us a lot, I think.
Yeah. Well, I know it was a long time ago. And I know memories like that can kind of shift and morph. But I mean, how did you feel about that?
As a kid, you know, because I was a kid, I was young enough, I wasn't in touch with my emotions, you know, the way someone who was older was. I remember how I felt in part by thinking about how I behaved. I know that for a while we were very spastic and kind of out of control a lot of the time. You know, we were all over the place. Life had been orderly and now it was just sort of anything goes. And we certainly started misbehaving in a lot of ways because it was this feeling that like all bets were off. I also, in my memory, I have this feeling, if you think about like a distant alarm sound that slowly fades in and gets, it's sort of a drone that gets louder and louder and closer, and that sort of slowly increasing anxiety or dread that comes with that kind of a sound, that is what I feel when I remember those days. And I think that is a lot of what was happening inside me, was as more and more things happened, this dread and anxiety just grew increment by increment. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the block where you were in high school? What did your life look like? What was going on with your mom? And also, like, how did you see that affecting Tom? And how were you guys navigating through that?
So after kind of the first couple of years of my mother's illness involved a lot of sort of dramatic events, but things settled out in a day-to-day way by the time I was about in eighth grade. And we settled into a joint custody agreement where we would live with my dad for 1 week and then my mom for 1 week. So my life all through high school was this thing of half the time being at my dad's house, which was incredibly orderly and put together, and my dad was, you know, a businessman and on top of everything, and then going to my mom's house, and there would be no food in the fridge, and she would forget to notice us for hours at a time, and we just sort of were feral. But my mother, I will say, my mother was always the very loving person to the extent that she was capable of being with her illness, and we chose to live with her half the time because we wanted to be with her even when she was ill. And in a lot of ways, I liked being at her house. And so it was this really like, I mean, black and white, opposite ends of the spectrum back and forth was my life. And, you know, I learned to rely on my dad for practical things and for things that I wanted to make sure, problems that got solved. And at my mother's house, it was just this kind of quiet flow that we had with her, always working around, you know, whatever maybe she was struggling with and trying to take care of each other in a very unconscious way, I think. You know, we really didn't talk about it. We didn't go to therapy or anything like that. So my brother and sister and I just kind of instinctually developed a way to be with her that worked for us. But a lot of the time, I was very disconnected from myself and from the world. I think I blocked a lot of things out. I think I was shut down on some level that I didn't realize I was until, you know, I was in my 20s and looked back and thought, you know, I mean, I still look back sometimes and I think, where was I? I didn't have a normal teenager experience in the way that, you know, you see on TV shows or in YA novels. all those experiences of discovering who you are. I didn't really have that. I was just kind of going through the motions of my life. And I didn't really kind of find myself until I got out of there and went to college and was then sort of free to think about other things.
Right.
Yeah.
When you were getting ready to leave to go to college or kind of at the end of your high school, what was going on with Tom at that time?
Well, partly it's hard for me to answer this question because I think none of us were doing great. And so I was not necessarily able to see the ways that Tom wasn't doing well because I wasn't doing particularly well either. And my memories of Tom in high school, I didn't register that there was anything at all that was off at that time, or not any more so than the rest of us. In high school, I remember Tom as being, I would say he was depressed in high school, but I didn't see that at the time. He was someone who, he didn't have a lot of friends, but he had close friends. The friends that he had were great, and he was very connected to them. And he always did well in school. He always got A's. And I do recall that he wanted to be, he played soccer and he really wanted to be a varsity soccer player, but he never was able to make the varsity team, which was something that seemed weird to me, given how talented he was physically. I think, I mean, I write in the book about what an incredible skier he was. And I think now maybe, you know, it had to do with that depression and the beginnings of something not connecting for him that made it hard for him on the soccer field to, you know, perform to what would have been, you know, the fullest of his abilities.
Right. And of course, Tom was outdoorsy and got into climbing and all that stuff. Can you talk a little bit about, I guess, that outlet for Tom and kind of how you saw it?
I mean, we were always a skiing family, so that was always happening. And then I think when he went to college at the University of Colorado, when he was in Boulder, I think that's when I saw him really latching on to a lot of those outdoor activities. He would go mountain biking there. He had a mountain bike. He started learning how to rock climb. And his friend Zach, who I know you know as well, you know, Zach and him were very close from high school. And then in the summers, when Tom would come back from college, they started, you know, doing all kinds of outings that they would do where they'd go hiking or climbing or biking around. So it was really in the college years that I really saw Tom kind of embracing that fully. And really, he would do everything. He didn't seem to have one thing that he liked best. He would even, you know, he would go camping by himself. He just liked to be out there.
Right. And then you have mentioned to me that he had done some mountain climbing expeditions. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, he and Zach did a couple. And those were around those college years, maybe a little later. I mean, this was like getting close to when his illness set in. So, he, you know, 22, maybe. One thing they did was they got some kind of a scholarship. They got funded to climb the Moose's Tooth. And so the two of them went and climbed it together. They had never done anything that challenging before. You know, it's technical, it's high elevation, it's remote, it's all of those things. And they went and climbed the Moose's Tooth, like, with no problem. And I have pictures of it. I know it happened. And so that was like the big one, like, oh my God, Tom climbed the Moose's Tooth. Like, you know, and with not much of a lead up to that either. And he and Zach also, they did a whole biking expedition through Europe. They started in Amsterdam, I think, and ended up in Morocco. And along the way, they stopped in the Alps and did some climbing up around there. I've seen photos of that, you know, of them doing hut trips and climbing when they could, and then biking on. So those were, I think, the main big things that he was able to do before his illness set in.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, when a shift started to happen for Tom? I mean, and I know that from what I'm remembering about the book, I know that it was a little bit challenging for you because, you know, as you've said, like, you were kind of navigating your own things through your early adulthood, like we all have. And Mm-hmm. And you weren't always around. And so I guess if you can just kind of talk about some of those memories of when you started to notice a shift and just talk about what that was like for you and your family.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it first became apparent to me, and I don't think I even described this moment in the book, but there was a phone call that I had with him one spring. He had dropped out of the University of Colorado and was doing day trading online and like making a lot of money. And so again, these are unusual life choices, but for my family, it was totally like, okay, you know, nobody looked askance at that. Although now looking back, I think he was struggling in school and decided to, you know, give up on it for a while. But it wasn't until a year or so after he dropped out of college that I had a phone call with him in which it really sounded like he was describing things happening that were hallucinations. And the way he talked about them, he didn't seem to have any awareness that they were hallucinations. And those two things together were very much like my mother. So it was a sort of conversation that maybe someone who had never witnessed schizophrenia or known anyone with a schizophrenia type illness would not have registered that something was wrong. But I felt that I knew exactly what I was hearing. And so that was an enormous moment for me that really set off the chain of events that I discuss in the book of trying to confirm, to find out for sure if this was happening, and then trying to convince Tom to get some kind of help for it. And I was, you know, thousands of miles away from him much of this time. Either I was in Alaska when he was in Colorado, or later he was in Alaska and I had moved out of the state. And we did get him back to Alaska. He was deteriorating for a couple of years before things really started to have movement, I think, because no one could convince him that it was worth trying to find help to turn his life around. I think he just thought that he didn't know why he was struggling. It was clear he was struggling, but he didn't know why. And he didn't want to take our suggestions as far as finding out. And eventually he lost his apartment, had to sell his car, ran out of money, started getting into trouble with the law. One of those situations led to an investigation in which my dad was notified. And then once my dad was involved, he started doing what he could do to work with the system to, again, try to get help for Tom. That case was put through the mental health court in Anchorage, which is a wonderful aspect of the system that is not everywhere, but we were very grateful that it does exist in Anchorage. And Tom agreed to go through the mental health court, and what he received in lieu of jail time was a year of outpatient treatment. And during that time, he was prescribed an antipsychotic, and he was required to take it during that term. But he didn't want to take it. He eventually did, and it was remarkable the difference it made. He was able to get a job. He started working at REI as a stalker, and then they put him up front. He was working, you know, as a checker. I went and visited once while he was doing that. You could see, you know, him up there at the cash register handling customers. He was on top of it. So this was incredible. We really hoped that things were turning around. But at the same time, it didn't really seem like Tom was fully on board. And when the mandated treatment term was up, Tom said that he wanted to go off the antipsychotic. And of course, everyone tried to convince him to stay on it. My dad did, his psychiatrist did, and even Zach, his friend, you know, had a conversation with him. Zach was trying to understand, and he said, you know, why don't you just take it? And my brother said, when I take it, I feel embarrassed. He felt embarrassed about being diagnosed with schizophrenia. He felt embarrassed about the condition of his life. And I think it deeply, deeply affected him that he was a young man who suddenly was not in control of his destiny. And I think he wanted, for him, it was a way of taking control of his destiny. But unfortunately, that was really the beginning of a long series of events of homelessness, of jail time, of time in the psychiatric hospital in Anchorage, API, and moments of improving, but then falling through the cracks again, and mostly being without treatment and being unwilling to let us and his family offer him anything substantive in the way of help.
Right. And I I do want to talk to you more about that time period of Tom's life, but I also want to talk to you about that period of your life.
Sure. I mean, you had said, it was challenging for me when my brother got sick, which I think is the world's biggest understatement. It was hugely traumatic for me when my brother got sick, and it hurled me into a place inside myself where I didn't know what direction was up. You know, I had survived my childhood with my mother's illness, and I had sort of found a path for myself that seemed to be working. When my brother got sick, it was like a bomb exploded in the middle of my life. And for years after that, I think I was doing all kinds of things to try to cope. I was just trying to figure out how to get through it. That was the time I had been on a science track. I decided to ditch science, which I think was something that was a long time coming, but I was realizing that I wanted to be a much more creative person than that. And I think that, me going into science had something to do with being shut down in my teen years and early adulthood. And as I was opening up, I was, getting into music and movies and visual art, all kinds of things. So then Tom got sick, and that was what I turned to get through it. And I did go through this sort of crazy dressing phase, I think you could say. I started wearing extremely bright colors, sparkly things. I was like rainbows. And I dyed my hair like 4 different colors. I had like blonde and pink and turquoise, For a long time, I had no idea even why I was doing that. And it was only much later that I was able to look back and start to say, I think I was trying to talk about my experience. I think I was trying to communicate something to the world about what it was like to be in my position and to keep losing people to schizophrenia, and then also needing to help or try to help them to survive schizophrenia. And it was sort of like, for me, it all came out sort of in a refracted way.
Right. So kind of moving back towards this part of Tom's life, which was, really chaotic. And at least for me, from the outside, reading about it in the books, really sad. Can you talk about just kind of the trajectory of events that he was going through?
Well, early on in his homelessness, and his homelessness occurred after he had gone off his medications. He and my father were fighting about it. He was living with my dad. My dad had been taking care of him. One day they had a big sort of blowout fight, and Tom left the house and didn't come back for weeks. Then eventually Tom got arrested again on some minor charge. His charges were always things like trespassing, or one time it was writing bad checks. And it was clear that he didn't know that there was no money in the account. So this was not true criminal behavior, really, but it kept landing him in jail. So at the beginning there, that first summer, there was an incident with a reporter in the Anchorage newspaper who wrote a column about Tom. He had met him and tried to interact with him. He had seen him walking on the coastal trail. And Tom had been acting acutely psychotic, as he was in it. He was in the grip of psychosis at this time. He didn't do anything aggressive or at all frightening, but the reporter concluded that, he concluded the piece by linking it to a man who had been murdering children and saying that he was going to keep an eye on my brother. So this was horrible for us to receive. I was beyond furious. And it was a real kind of wake-up call for me. I mean, I had understood the existence of the stigma that occurs towards mental illness and schizophrenia in particular, but I had really never seen it visited upon us quite in this way. And it made me fearful of Tom being out there in a way I had not been afraid of before. Because, Tom was such a great outdoorsman. Even in the thick of his illness, he was quite good at you know, keeping himself alive. And a lot of times in the summer, he would live in the woods by the coastal trail. He would have camps. We would try to keep him supplied in outdoor gear, which he would, you know, always lose or something. We never knew. He could never hang on to anything for long. So my dad would keep a stockpile of clothing and other items at the house to kind of dole out to Tom whenever he saw him, if Tom would be willing to take him. But this whole other element of fear beyond, you know, the fear of nature in Alaska was the fear of other people and what might be done to Tom if he was, you know, he could be easily victimized. Our low point as a family was a few years in, and Tom had an incident in a neighbor's yard. He had obviously deteriorated to a pretty bad place and had started shouting obscenities to the neighbor, and the neighbor was scared and called the police. And the police came, and because Anchorage has a system called Crisis Intervention Team Training, they have police officers who are trained to deal specifically with people who are in mental health crises, to not escalate, to not treat them the way you would behave as a police officer toward a criminal. And one of these police officers came and asked Tom if he would like to go to API, and he said yes. And during that period at API, he was accepting treatment. He had apparently decided at this point that he was ready to start trying to get better and take medication and doing what he needed to do to get his life to a better place. So this was wonderful for us. But unfortunately, Tom fell through the cracks in the system this time again when he was transferred out of API to a sort of a halfway house type situation. He didn't seem to be able to handle the environment in the halfway house, the other people. I think he was very fearful of other people a lot of the time, loud noises. It was hard for him to be indoors. It was hard for him to be in crowds of people. He would get stressed out. I imagine he would get paranoid. And something happened at the place, and he ended up back on the street. And once he was homeless, again, there was no way for him to get the medication he wanted. He was at this point also had cut off communication with my dad for reasons that are unclear, but probably had to do with his illness. And so my sister went up to visit him, and she went and found him. When we would go home, we would literally just go out driving around the streets looking for him. I mean, that's what you do when someone you love is homeless. You ask around. You drive around, you know, we put word out to everybody. If you see Tom, let us know. My sister went, and she was walking down on the coastal trail near Lineri Park. And she said Tom came up behind her and just started walking in sync with her as she went. He didn't even say anything. and then she turned and saw him, and she said, "Oh, hi, Tom." And he said, "Hi." So that visit, she was able to hear from him about what had happened to him, you know, at API and afterwards. And it became clear to us that he had actually been trying to help himself at that time. But the demands that the system made on him were not things he was capable of doing in the state of being as ill as he was. And so once again, we were back to square one of him being homeless.
Right. So can you talk about the last year or so when Tom was alive and any interactions you had, or just what was going on during that time?
Well, the last time I saw Tom, I think it was a couple years before he died. I had gone up to Anchorage for about a week, and I went and found him. And I actually found him at Bean's Cafe and talked to him for about an hour. And then I went back the next day, and he wouldn't talk to me. I believe that in the time of our conversation, I had noticed he was growing increasingly sort of stressed out and suspicious seeming. And I think that whatever was going on in his head, he decided I couldn't be trusted and I couldn't be talked to. So the last time I saw him was him refusing to see me. So that, you know, that's always with me. At the time that he died, he had ended up in API again because it was the middle of the winter It was February. He had been sleeping a lot at the Brother Francis shelter. And for some reason that February, the shelter changed their policy. I mean, and the reason was probably overcrowding, but they changed their policy. It had been you could sleep 30 nights there, and then you had to spend one night away before you could sleep 30 nights there again. Well, they changed the policy in February to you had to spend 30 nights away before coming back for 30 nights. And it was single digits that February. And so Tom, being the smart person that he was, he went and trespassed somewhere because he knew then he would get arrested and taken to jail. And he hated jail. Jail was a very stressful, difficult place for him, but it was a place where he could sleep and be warm and survive the winter. So that was his plan. Once he got arrested, they sent him to API because it was clear that he was not, you know, mentally competent to stand trial. And once he had been in API for a little while, he contacted my dad and we became sort of able to participate in this. And this was his third stay at API. This time they let him stay longer. I think they understood that he was very, very sick and he needed more help than the usual quick cycling through. And he became much more coherent. I was able to talk to him once summer came. I think May or June, I finally was allowed to talk to him. And I had conversations with him and he was able to talk about what was happening and what was going on with him. But he was still very confused. I think it's important to point out that when someone has untreated schizophrenia for that many years in a row, in circumstances as stressful as homelessness, he just got sicker and sicker and sicker as time went on. And the same medication that had brought him back to being able to, you know, be that great employee at REI several years before, by this time, he was permanently changed. I can't know that it was permanent, but the medication was not able to help him nearly as much as it had been able to at the beginning, because I just think the psychosis had done so much damage already. But again, I was so happy. I was just so happy that we were, you know, he was talking to me and we had him back. And again, he was going to need to be discharged to a halfway house. And at this point, we didn't know what had happened in the other halfway house, really, only very vaguely. And so we felt hopeful about this, but Tom didn't make it that far. Just about a week before he was going to be discharged, he found a way inside the psychiatric hospital to take his own life.
Yeah.
It's very upsetting.
It's one of those stories that you never think you're going to tell. It's one of those stories that even as I say it, I think to myself, I can't believe this is what I'm saying. I will say my brother's suicide was something that none of us at all saw coming. It was an enormous shock. And it was so especially painful to be happening just when we thought maybe at last we had turned a corner. And I I mean, it's a little hard to describe what happened to me. For years I was in a different place after that happened. I think it took me 6 months just for it to sink in. And then from there, I spent a lot of time just trying to, I mean, I'm a writer. I spend time finding stories to tell myself that make sense to me. And, you know, so part of the book is me doing that. I learned the news from my dad on the phone. And I threw the phone down. I have a very distinct memory. My dad said it, and I threw my phone down onto the bed, and it bounced and then landed on the floor. And then I stared at it for a second, and then I scrambled to pick it up again and said, "Dad, are you still there?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm here." And I said, "Sorry, I threw the phone down." And he said, yeah. I think now I spend a lot of time thinking about what Tom was great at. I like to think about how smart he was, how creative he was, how much fun we could have together. My brother and I, we were actually quite a lot of alike in some ways, in terms of the way our minds worked, which is, you know, kind of a rare thing to find someone whose mind kind of works like yours. And so I like to think about those moments that I had with him when we could really kind of sync up. And I like to remember how beautiful he was. You know, as a young man, he was strong. He had a big smile. He was generous and open-hearted. So those are the images that I hold on to now. One thing I would like to say, part of our difficulty in getting help for Tom is that he was up there in Alaska, far away from the rest of the country, far away from other options that we might have tried for mental health care. There was no other hospital that he could go to besides API. There was no private psychiatric hospital in Alaska that we could try to send him to convince him to go to where he could stay for longer if he needed to. But we were afraid that if we sent him down to the lower 48, then he would just wander away and we'd never see him again. In Anchorage, at least, there was a community of people who knew us and who knew him. The police knew him, which was important because, you know, sometimes I was afraid of the police when it came to Tom. And as it happened in Anchorage, there were no incidents in which that needed to be the case. But that was a very real concern for us. And but there were people in Anchorage who looked out for Tom. People that we had grown up with, friends of mine, friends of my sister's, friends of Tom's from high school, you know, family friends, West High School teachers who remembered him. And one thing that really struck me after he died and we all flew home and did a memorial, I realized how many people in that room had known Tom primarily as a person who had schizophrenia and that they loved him as a person who had schizophrenia. It wasn't that they had loved the person he had been before he was sick, although many of them had. It was that they loved him for who he was when he was sick. And I think that speaks a lot to who Tom was and what a special person he was, but also what an incredible community that we had there that he was able to be a part of. And that community, in no small part, is how he survived 7 years, seven Alaskan winters outside.
I really appreciate you being so honest and open about that. I mean, it's devastating to think about and hear you talk about it. You know, I'm not surprised that you're having feelings talking about this. You know, I could certainly sense, you know, reading the book, how painful this has been for you and your family. And it even goes beyond Tom. It's, you know, the stuff with your whole life, what you've experienced. You know, everybody's experience in life is so unique, but, you know, this has been a unique and very painful experience for you and your family. And so I'm not surprised at all. And I'm glad that you are speaking with me about it. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I want people to hear these stories. Because, I mean, like as we were talking about at the beginning, everyone has a mental health story of some kind. Many of them are not as, you know, severe as my family's story. But everyone has a story, and I grew up not hearing any stories about the circumstances of my life. And I would like for that to not be the case for somebody who's, you know, the age I was when my mom got ill today.
Yeah. Can you talk about, you know, what the experience of writing the book, what was that like for you? And how did it feel to write it? And how do you feel about the book now?
Well, I can say a couple things right off the bat. One, it took a long time to write it. It took about 8 years from the time I wrote the first thing that eventually became a chapter in it and the time it came out. And I mean, as I'm sure you noticed, it's not a typical memoir. It's not a linear narrative. It doesn't tell one single story. It doesn't tell a story of one single person. So just on a technical level, it was a very challenging book to figure out how to write. But that for me was so much of the reward of it as well. Because how do you take a story of a family that has multiple generations of schizophrenia type illness? How do you take a story of growing up with a mother who is in the grip of psychosis and then having a brother develop the illness? How do you take all of these fragments that are so diverse and put them into a single book in a way that does the story any justice? And I started out by trying to tell the story a traditional way, as a linear, chronological, you know, narrative. But nothing about my experience with mental illness spoke to that kind of narrative. I mean, nothing about my life really fit that shape at all. And so I very quickly became frustrated by that. And what I started doing was I started writing these little spin-off essays. I would be sort of trying to slug my way through this straightforward telling of it, feeling like I was just killing it as I went, just killing whatever the thing was, whatever it was I needed to say about schizophrenia was just not making it onto the page when I forced it into that form. And so I started writing these random essays that were in these weird forms. And each one just, I would say one thing that I wanted to say about schizophrenia would be at the heart of that essay. And I would find a way to shape it so that it came out, so that it got onto the page in a way that felt true. And those essays then ended up becoming the book, because I scrapped much of the linear storyline halfway through and said, okay, I'm going to take these essays and I'm going to put them together and I'm going to make a full book out of them. And there are some chapters, some sections that are sort of more traditional narrative mode. But for the most part, the book is reflective of my experience in that it is disjointed, it is multifaceted, it is fragmented, and it is colorful. And I wanted the story I told to be all of those things, because that is what my life has felt like. So in that sense, I am incredibly happy with the book. I'm incredibly happy that I managed to get the story out in a way that felt true, because that was the hardest thing to do. And beyond that, I mean, I think that's what I was really in it for anyway. So beyond that, whatever else happens with the book, that's fine, because I got what I was going for.
Right, right.
There were times when it was very hard to write emotionally. There were pieces of the book that I stalled on writing for a long time. The vagabond chapters, the ones about Tom's time of homelessness, I wrote about 75 or 80 pages in one go over a period of 2 months. And during those 2 months, I sat down with my husband, who is incredibly supportive and loving. And I said, you know, I don't think I'm going to be cleaning the house or cooking dinner or buying groceries or really doing anything in the next 2 months except getting these words out. And when I'm not writing, I think I'm going to be watching a lot of bad television and taking the dog for walks. And that's what I did.
Right.
I just had to kind of go into that all into an alternate place in order to get it out.
Yeah.
And it took absolutely everything I had. That was everything I had, you know?
Yeah.
but I got it out, and I'm so glad that I did, because it was transformative for me in a way to write it. It gave me purchase on it. It gave me a way to have a relationship to it that doesn't just feel confounding and confusing all the time. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done, but it was absolutely worth it.
All right, well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I want to give a big heartfelt thanks to Maren for her honesty and openness and willingness to share her story today on this episode. To learn more about the work Maren does and to get her book, The Edge of Every Day, Sketches of Schizophrenia, just head on over to marensardi.com. You can also find the book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or any online store where good books are sold. Hey, just a reminder, if you enjoy The Fern Line, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you're looking for a way to support the show, you can become a monthly subscriber over on patreon.com/thefernline. And speaking of Patreon, I want to give a huge shout out to Leo Franchi, who supports the show each month at the executive producer level. Thank you so much, Leo. Your support is a huge help. All right, and finally, if you enjoy the tunes you hear on this show, you can check out more of my music on Apple Music, Spotify, Bandcamp, and evanphillipsmusic.com. All right, take care of yourselves, be well. I'm Evan Phillips, and we'll catch you next time on The Fern Line.
Follow.